All right, let's call this meeting of Senate Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 3:42 p.m. on Friday, April 9th, 2021. Let the record also reflect that we have a quorum today. Present are Senator Stevens, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Keel, and myself, Senator Rivak. Senator Von Imhoff is excused, and a few others are headed this way from another meeting. Staffing today's committee is committee aide Betty Tangerman, LIO moderator Nate Williams, and Christopher Dickrell online from records. Thank you to you all. Please turn off your or silence your cell phones. Today's agenda has two items. We are canceling SB 97 state land sales and leases, and we're going to try and hear that on Monday just for some clerical some amendments that we needed, some clarifying stuff. So we're going to push that to Monday. We're going to proceed with the other two items, SB 61 oil and gas lease, DNR modified net profit share, and SB 104 geothermal resources. And we're going to start out with geothermal resources today. This is a governor's bill. We have Steve Masterman, director of the Division of Geographical and Geophysical Surveys with DNR, and Haley Payne, Deputy Director of DNR, online to provide us a short presentation and to answer any questions committee members might have. So with that, Mr. Masterman, if you are ready, please put yourself on the record and begin.
Yes, for the record, this is Steve Masterman. I am Director of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys, and hopefully you can all hear me well.
We can, sir. Thank you.
Very good. Greetings from Fairbanks. It's a beautiful sunny day here. So at the committee's request, we have abbreviated our presentation. We gave a presentation on the geothermal bill during the last legislature. It was quite a bit longer than what we're going to do today, so we just have a few slides. And if we could proceed to the next slide, which is the agenda for our presentation. Ms. Payne with the Division of Oil and Gas and I are going to tag team this. I am going to lead off with the introduction. And then Ms. Payne is going to take over for a few slides, go over the overview of the bill, which will be fairly abbreviated. And then I'm going to address a couple of examples of geothermal systems, just following up on a request from Senator Rivek to just talk a little bit about how this or the changes proposed in this piece of legislation will affect a couple of real-world examples. And then the last bullet on this slide here, the supplemental information, is basically the information that we presented to the committee last legislative session that we are not going to go over today, and it's all supplemental material at the back of the presentation. So a very abbreviated presentation. It shouldn't take us too long, and there will be plenty of opportunity for questions. Okay, the next slide, please. This should be slide 3, which is titled Introduction. And we have more or less done that, and so we're going to move on to the next slide, slide 4, which is titled The Purpose of SB 104. And as we've explained in our prior presentation, this bill does a number of things to try to modernize Alaska's statutes with regard to geothermal exploration. And I think that's in response to the recognition that Alaska's geothermal systems have not been as developed as we would like them to be. And so we are trying to revise statute to make exploration of our geothermal resources more attractive to industry and thereby promote their exploration and ultimately development in order to, as it says, promote clean energy industry jobs. So a number of the proposed changes in this legislation really align geothermal leasing and licensing with that of the oil and gas exploration program within the Division of Oil and Gas. And it might seem a little odd, but in in a lot of ways, it makes a lot of sense. In the oil and gas industry, you know, we have oil shows on surface, and we may not know where the reservoir is that is responsible for those oil shows. And so, you know, oil companies may lease a large area and take a long period of time doing their exploration work to trace the source of that oil and gas that's showing up on the surface. And the same really applies to geothermal energy as well. If we have a hot spring, that's obviously a great sign that there's an active geothermal system in the area, but we don't know where the reservoir is. It might be right under the hot springs, or it might not be. And the examples I'll go into here in a little while will illustrate that. And so it takes time for a company to understand the geology, do the repeated rounds of exploration that are necessary to track the hot water back to the reservoir, and then explore that reservoir and hopefully find commercially viable levels of geothermal energy. So really, a couple of the key things in this bill are to increase the amount of time available for a geothermal company to explore the area and to try to find that reservoir, and then to provide a larger area for them to explore within. And as we'll see from the examples, both of those things are quite necessary. Another aspect of this legislation is to modernize and the definition of what a geothermal resource is. And that has really come about because of technological advancements. Technology now allows development of lower temperature resources, and our existing statute has a temperature limit in there, which is not really legitimate anymore, I guess, based on the changes in technology. And this proposed legislation also really explicitly excludes domestic, non-commercial, and small-scale industrial usage from the need for a geothermal license or lease. And I think we all recognize that we DNR does not want to get into the business of regulating a small home personal heat pump, and I'm sure the citizens of Alaska do not want DNR to be involved in regulating their small domestic heat pumps. And so this legislation pretty clearly carves that out and says, no, we're not interested in that. What we really need to focus on here are the big opportunities and regulate those. So with that, I will turn it over to Ms. Payne for an overview of SB 104.
Hello, thank you, Director Masterman. Good afternoon to the committee. For the record, my name is Haley Payne, and I am the Deputy Director of the Division of Oil and Gas. I would like to briefly walk us through the history and current status of geothermal leasing and permitting in the state, and then provide a very quick sectional summary of the proposed changes in the bill that were already described in the purpose. So if we could please move to slide 6. Since 1983, the state has held 4 geothermal lease sales, 3 in the Mount Spur area and 1 on Augustine Island. For these, the commissioner designated the areas based on substantial indications of geothermal resources and thus called for competitive sale of tracts. The bill before you today would not make any changes to the competitive leasing process. As you can see, there is the one example in 2008, we had a sale at Mount Spur, and that sale is the only one that actually resulted in on-the-ground exploration activities. However, those tracts have since been relinquished. Currently, there are 2 pending applications for a geothermal exploration prospecting permit. These 2 pending permittees would stand to benefit from the proposed changes that are in this bill. We did issue the final best interest finding for the first one in March, and the second one, it was for the preliminary finding there at the end of March. Moving on to slide 7, here we have the sectional summary of the bill. And so in Section 2, there is the first of several terminology changes where we use the word license instead of permit. Again, as was already alluded to, this is to align this with oil and gas exploration licensing. Section 2 also provides for the explicit exemption that a prospecting license or lease is not required under this section to explore for, develop, or use geothermal resources if the resource is intended for domestic, non-commercial, or small-scale industrial use. And lastly, in Section 2, the preferential rights provision is being removed. It is more relevant to water rights or other surface use cases that are not associated with the mineral estate. The other provisions not applying this to domestic use will continue to further protect those private rights. In Section 3, this is where we're actually getting to some of those changes where we're increasing the length of the license. So currently it is only 2 years, and we propose to extend that out to 5. Another major change is the conversion process. So once you have a permit or a license, you may then convert into a lease. We were going to modify this from making a showing of a geothermal resource discovery in commercial quantities to the completion of an agreed-upon work commitment. The work commitment is the standard that is currently in place for oil and gas licensing. And so in that program, you have a work commitment that is expressed in dollars of direct exploration expenditures. And we believe that this gives the most flexibility to be able to work with folks in the different areas instead of having as finite of a definition of a commercial quantity discovery. The sectional analysis kind of continues, but some of the other major changes that I will point out are in Section 5, the maximum acreage is increased from 51,200 to 100,000 acres. And also we see the modernization of the definitions of geothermal fluids and geothermal resources to account for some of those changes in technology and remove temperature requirements that are currently in statute. And so with that, that is kind of the summary of the sectional analysis there. And if there are no questions before we move on, I'll hand it back to Director Masterman to show some examples of these.
Thank you. Do we have committee questions for Ms. Payne or Director Masterman?
Mr.
Yes, Senator Stevens.
Just a quick question. One of the difficulties we found with hydro power is that the federal government does not recognize it as renewable. Is geothermal considered renewable or not?
This is, for the record, this is Steve Masterman again. Through the chair, Senator Stevens, one of the things that came into effect in the Agile Act that was passed recently is the definition of geothermal energy as a renewable energy source.
Oh, great. That's great to hear, Steve. I appreciate that.
Thank you. Other questions? All right, Senator Keel.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two questions. One's on the redefinition of geothermal resources. I notice in the status quo definition, helium is explicitly not a geothermal resource if it comes up with the hot water. And the new definition doesn't exclude helium. Would that become a mineral, or how would that be treated with the new definition?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I think I would ask Ms. Payne to provide her opinion on that. I'm not an expert on how that would be treated.
Thank you, Ms. Payne.
Sure, Senator Keel, through the chair. We took out some of the specific minerals there, but we would have to follow up with you on that particular case to discuss it. So I could send some follow-up information to help explain how that may be treated with it removed from this particular definition.
Thank you, Ms. Payne. If you could send that to our office and we'll distribute to the committee, we'd also appreciate receiving that answer. Follow-up? Sure. Another question, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I remember talking through this last year, in removing the preference right for the current surface owner. I understand that that treats sort of these large area leases more like our oil and gas leases. The preference right did serve as a sort of an extra notice to somebody who has a cabin or, you know, whatever, that there might be a geothermal prospecting going on or drilling going on underneath and around their land. With that preference and opportunity to take that removed, what is the notice now to a surface landowner who might have some geothermal prospectivity? What would they get now in terms of notice and opportunity?
Senator Keel, through the chair. So under our current process and would be maintained with the changes to this bill, the director must provide a written finding that finds that the disposal of the land is in the best interest of the state. And so a part of the best interest finding process is a highly public review where all of the different communities, municipalities, native organizations, and landowners are notified. We have publications through local newspapers, posting at the post offices. And so there's a rigorous public notice process of when we first receive an application. And then in the authoring of the preliminary finding, we publish that, and then notice goes out yet again for folks to have the opportunity to provide their comment and their feedback. And so we feel there is a very robust public process with multiple opportunities to reach as many different organizations and individuals as possible in order to alert them of potential activities in their area.
And just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman. That notice, I wasn't clear on what you said. Does that go specifically to the owners of record of those surface parcels as well?
Senator Keel, through the chair. So it goes to the different local organizations. It's at the post office. It could be on the radio and in the newspaper. At this time, we do not send individual letters to the different landowners themselves, but we do make that information available through multiple public venues within the area.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? All right. It doesn't look like we have other questions at this time. If you could please proceed, I think it's Mr. Masterman.
Yes, thank you. Chairman Rebeck, for the record, this is Steve Masterman, Director of Division of Geological Geophysical Surveys. And if we could advance the slides to slide 9, which is the slide for Mount Spur, we can talk a little bit about a couple of examples of geothermal systems within the state. So this slide has a couple of maps on it. The one on the left is a little bit more of a regional picture, which shows the location on the left-hand side of the Mount Spur hot springs, and also one of the volcanic vents for Mount Spur is very close by. And then you can see Cook Inlet in the center of the map, Anchorage just on the right-hand side, and also shown on there are the roads and the power lines, and the roads are in gray, and the power lines are in a brown pattern with little dots along them that trace back from Anchorage out to the power plant at Beluga. So this is just to show sort of the regional setting here where the hot springs field is in relation to the communities and to the power grid and the road system. So it's about 35 miles from the power grid and the road system, and obviously there would need to be a spur line put in and an access road should these systems be commercially viable. The figure on the right is zoomed in a little bit and shows the location again of the hot springs here. The hot springs are the red dots kind of in the upper left-hand corner of that map, and it shows where the Mount Spur volcanic vent is. It also shows the area of the two permits that have been applied for, one by GeoAlaska and the other by Razor Geothermal, that are in the immediate vicinity of the hot springs. And it shows in those sort of blue dots the drill holes that were drilled by the last explorer at Mount Spur, which was Ormat. And then in the colors here are the geology. The green areas are tertiary sediments. In this case, they're mostly the West Foreland Formation, which is a series of conglomerates. And then in the pinks are the volcanic rocks and the intrusive rocks associated with Mount Spur. So the geology is somewhat complicated here. The Capps Glacier Fault, which is just shown to the east of Mount Spur, and the Lake Clark Fault, which is in the center of the figure, are major geological features that have considerable offset across them. And so in the case of the Capps Glacier Fault, the offset is displacing the sediments against the volcanic sequence. And so you can see that the drilling done by Ormat was on the southeast side of the Capps Glacier Fault. And in this particular case, they would be were the geothermal equivalent of a duster in the mineral exploration world, or a dry or a cold hole. They drilled through the volcanic rocks, which were fairly shallow or thin at that location, and drilled into the underlying sedimentary rocks and stayed in those to the bottom of the hole. The deepest hole was about 4,000 feet, and they did not intersect any hot water, any warm water, or any hot rocks or warm rocks. This is strictly 100% miss on their part. Now, obviously, they drilled in that location for a reason, but their reasoning appears to have been incorrect. And so for the new explorers in this area, they have that information. They know now where the geothermal system is not, but they still do not know where the geothermal reservoir that is sourcing these hot springs is located. So they have a difficult task in front of them. They have to try to trace the hot water back from the surface exposure to the reservoir and drill into that reservoir. And so they're going to use the tools at their disposal, geology and geophysics. They have to try to see through the volcanic rocks that are on the surface to try to trace the Capps Glacier Fault underneath those volcanic rocks, and try to understand the structural situation there to see, you know, what might be bringing up, what faults might be bringing up this hot water, and then to trace those back to the source. And so when you're faced with a problem like this, it takes time. It's not a slam dunk, as Ormat found out. And so it'll take them a period of seasons out there, of summers, to send geologists out there to do the geologic mapping, and then to do geophysical surveys, and then maybe do more geological mapping and more geophysical surveys before they start drilling. To drill now, unless you get lucky, would probably be inadvisable, because the geology is not sufficiently understood. So here is just a simple example. They need a fairly large land package. You can see those holes drilled by Ormat were drilled approximately 4 to 5 miles away from the surface expression of the hot springs. So that suggests the kind of area that these companies are looking to explore away from the surface expression. So 5 to 6 miles on either side of the surface expression is not that unheard of to locate the reservoir. Are there any questions about Mount Spur?
Yes, we have a question. Thank you, Mr. Masterman. We'll take the first question from Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thanks, Steve, for being online. Can you just sort of explain, you talked about the original, that geothermal resources are similar to oil and gas resources. And I understand, reservoir mechanics for an oil and gas field, but not for a geothermal field. So can you just explain sort of how that works?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, be happy to try to do that. So we're dealing with a fluid, basically just like oil and gas as a fluid. And so in this case, you know, if you drill into a geothermal reservoir, you're looking for a high temperature and a high fluid flow, which means a lot of energy can be extracted from that. So water gets into the reservoir from groundwater or from volcanic water that's coming out of the volcano itself. And the heat in this case is obviously being generated by the volcano because we're so close. So in an oil and gas reservoir, typically the reservoir is hosted in a porous rock, like a sandstone or a conglomerate or maybe a siltstone. And that's, you know, the intergranular space provides the porosity to host the oil and gas. Well, it can be the same thing in volcanic rocks. So we'd, you know, the companies would be looking to see, you know, what are the porous volcanic units out here. Maybe there are some volcanic breccias or volcanic ashes that are more porous than other ones and could be that conduit for the hot water migration. Another common feature that hosts geothermal resources are faults that again provide a mechanism for fluid flow because they're fractured and the fluids can migrate through the rocks, pick up the heat and make their way to the surface or into a borehole. So really what in many ways it's kind of analogous because you have a fluid that is hosted in a porous material that you are trying to drill into and extract. And in this case, because the surrounding rocks are hot, any water that flows back into that system will recharge the available resource that can then be extracted, which is a little bit different than oil and gas situations. So does that answer the question?
Sure, and I have a follow-up.
Yes, thank you. Follow-up?
So I recognizing that it is a renewable resource, if there were somebody that built a plant and somebody that built another plant nearby but within the same reservoir and one of them took some of that heat out, the heat energy out, how does that work when there's two plants that may be close to each other?
Through the chair, that's an excellent follow-up question. So I believe, and I hope Ms. Payne will step in if I get past my knowledge here, but the property boundaries for a geothermal or for a geothermal lease, I guess in that case, are vertical boundaries. And so, as in oil and gas, if you have a pooled reservoir, you have to work out the details of who owns what part of that reservoir, and you can't suck your neighbor's reservoir dry. And I believe the same would apply to this situation right here. We have two adjacent companies, and if the reservoir straddles the boundary and they both drill into it, there would have to be a resolution of those competing interests.
Oh, great. Thank you. Thank you, Steve. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We have a question from Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, thank you, Mr. Masterman. You may have covered this, but I might have missed it. How does the power generated at Mount Spur, for example, get to market to the places it's needed?
Through the chair, that's an excellent question. So if they are successful in drilling into an economically viable system at Mount Spur, there would be a power plant constructed close to the drill holes that intersected the geothermal resource where they would generate electricity, and then that electricity would have to run over a short intertie to tie into the power grid, presumably close to the Beluga power plant, and then feed into the rail belt electrical network. Obviously, the other thing that is often produced from geothermal systems is just heat by itself, and I think for that you might need to be closer to the end user than this particular location is.
Thank you, Stephen. And where is the Beluga power plant then on this map we're looking at Mount Spur? Is it
through the chair? The Beluga power plant, I believe, is just shortly north of Tyonek.
I see. Thank you.
Other questions? All right, please, Mr. Masterman, continue.
Okay, thank you. So we could proceed to the next slide, which is a slide for Pilgrim Hot Springs. And again, we have two maps here. The map on the left shows the regional geology, and it has the roads shown on there for that part of the Seward Peninsula. So you have Nome situated in the lower left part along the Bering Sea coast. And in the upper left is Teller, and in the right center is Council. Pilgrim Hot Springs is shown there in the middle of the figure. And immediately to the left of that is the Graphite Creek project, which is being developed by Graphite One. It's it's the nation's largest undeveloped graphite resource, and should it go into production, would be a moderate-sized mine. Nome currently has a power demand of about 6 megawatts, and the Graphite Creek mine, should it go into production, would require about the same amount of electricity. So they're looking at 3 2-megawatt diesel generators to power the recovery plant that would be functioning at that mine. So one thing to note here on that figure on the left, those heavier black lines, those are faults. And those faults have been active throughout geologic time and caused the area to the north of Pilgrim Hot Springs and Graphite Creek to drop down. It's actually a basin, a graben, much like the basins in the Basin and Range portion of Nevada. So that part's dropped down, and that's a fairly deep basin, probably several thousand feet deep. And those faults may play a pretty critical role in the geothermal picture at Pilgrim Hot Springs. So on the right here is a zoomed-in view of Pilgrim Hot Springs. It's right there in the center of the image, and then there's a small black box surrounding that, and that is a box that demonstrates the aerial extent of the geothermal exploration that's been done at Pilgrim over the years. And there have been 4 or 5 rounds of drilling, a couple of rounds of geophysical work, and so far that work has identified water that's about 90 degrees centigrade at a depth of about 300 feet, and then beneath that the temperatures drop. And what that is indicating is that the source of the hot water is not right underneath Pilgrim Hot Springs, but it is off somewhere to the side. Quite where to the side that is has yet to be determined. Now, the scale on this map, you can see in the lower left of that figure, the scale bar is 4 miles. In the Basin and Range of Nevada, there are many hot springs inside those basins, and in quite a few situations, the hot springs where the basins are deep are located a number of miles away from the faults that are bringing the hot water to the surface. So in this case, it's quite conceivable that those faults that are shown on this figure, those heavy black lines, are the source of the hot water, and that it is migrating up those faults until it gets into the sediments that are in that basin, and then migrating through those sediments until it finally reaches the surface at Pilgrim Hot Springs. So right now, as I said, the drilling has encountered 90-degree water, which it's estimated would be sufficient to have about a 5-megawatt power plant on site, which could supply, you know, much of the electrical need for Nome or for Graphite Creek. But if the postulated reservoir is intercepted, then this system may be able to produce tens of megawatts of electricity or fully fuel Nome and the Graphite Creek mine at the same time. So here we have a situation where we have exploration that's been done basically on a postage stamp right around the surface expression of the hot springs, and has succeeded in demonstrating that the source of the hot water is not right underneath the hot springs, that it's somewhere else. And so to develop this particular resource, what a company needs to come in and do is take a step back and you know, look at this from the 30,000-foot view or the 15,000-foot view and say, okay, well, it's not coming from right underneath it, so where could it be coming from? What information do we have? You know, what geology do we know? What information do we need to try to help us locate where those where the reservoir might be? And conceivably, it could be anywhere on this figure. So in order for a company to do that, a company would want to have a large land position and a period of time within which to do that exploration work. And that feeds into our proposed changes to statute here, is to provide that, you know, bigger land package so that you don't do all the legwork and then decide or come to the conclusion, well, dang, it's not quite on our property. It's on that guy's property right next door that we didn't lease because we were restricted in our lease size. You want to provide a big enough area that the explorer can be confident that they are going to, if they are successful, that the success will be on their property and not the guy who comes along after them. And then it just takes time. You know, this is a tough part of the world, expensive part of the world to work in. And understanding the geology is a complicated thing. So companies need longer periods of time. So I'd be happy to answer questions about Pilgrim.
Do we have any questions? We don't. Thank you, Mr. Masterman. Was that the completion of your presentation?
That is the completion of the presentation. The next slide is just a slide for questions, and any following materials are supplemental based on our previous presentation. So thank you, Chairman Rivak, and be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Well, thank you. We do have a question from Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Steve. I'm going to express my total lack of knowledge of geothermal here, but for a two-year period in my legislative career here, NACNIC was in my district, community of NACNIC, and when they first came into my district, I visited them, and they were in the process of building a geothermal plant, putting enormous amounts of money into it. Shortly after I lost them in redistricting, they all went bust, and the community lost enormous amounts of money. I guess the first question I have is, was the department involved in the permitting and leasing of the plant in NACNIC? And I guess what I'm really trying to get at, are there lessons learned there? What went wrong? In the end, it was a disaster for the community. It just helped me understand what went wrong with the NACNIC plant, if you were involved at all.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I was not involved in that. That was before my tenure here at DGGS. But we'd be happy to look into that and get back to you after the meeting if that would be of help.
Well, that'd be great to hear because there's got to be some important lessons learned in that experience. And I assume, even though you weren't there, Mr. Masterman, I assume the department must have permitted and leased the property in NACNIC. Would that be right?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, this is Haley Payne. Just to provide some background, the State of Alaska Department of Natural Resources did not lease or license those lands. So that may have occurred on private or other inholdings. But as Director Masterman indicated, we'd be happy to look into that more. But that was not a part of the state's licensing process. In terms of our best interest finding or actually providing the lease of the land.
I see. Well, I'm really pleased to hear that, the department was not involved in that. So if you can shed any light on it, I'd appreciate knowing a little bit more about what went wrong at NACNIC. Thank you.
Other questions at this point? Please continue.
Through the chair. I believe we are done with our presentation and conclude our remarks.
Okay, thank you very much. The chair is just stepping back, Mr. Chairman. the presentation is complete.
Thank you. Thank you both very much for being here. Next, we'll take brief comments from Jeremy Price, AOGCC Commissioner. Jeremy, if you could please put yourself on the record and give us very brief testimony.
Mr. Chairman, this is Jeremy Price with the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. For the record, I'm available for questions if there are any. The Department of Natural Resources did work with the commission to ensure that our definitions aligned in our titles 41 and 38 to ensure that there was consistency between DNR and AOGCC. So we appreciate their efforts and support this legislation. If there's anything further we can provide, please don't hesitate to ask.
Thank you, Mr. Price. Any questions?
I just have one more question for Mr. Masterman.
We have a question, Senator Machicki, for Mr. Masterman.
Yeah, and just the science of, and I have a background in oil and gas production, well technology. I'm just curious, once a geothermal resource is used, it's reinjected into the reservoir, does that cause the reservoir to be spent? Why is it not reinjected into another location?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I think from a permitting standpoint, it would be easier to reinject the water back into the reservoir because it's where it came from. And there should be few objections to doing that. And also, the water will not be completely cold. There will still be a lot of energy back or in that water as it goes back into the reservoir. And then it would take less energy to bring it back up to temperature and reuse it. So it's sort of going around in a loop, if you will.
Okay, thank you. I was just curious. I'm unaware of the magnitude of a geothermal reservoir, so I assume that makes sense. The magma is probably recharging faster than you're depleting the heat from the reservoir, I assume.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, yeah, the heat is coming, obviously, from the nearby magma, and hopefully the magma stays where it is and doesn't get into the hot water because that would cause quite a problem. But generally speaking, yes, you're correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Other questions? All right, thank you both very much for your time. This time we're going to move on to public testimony. Public testimony for SB, forgive me, 104 is now open. Do we have anyone online to testify? Seeing none, we have none in the room. I'm going to close public testimony. Public testimony is now closed. We're going to hold this bill for further consideration, and we're going to move on to SB 61.
There were brief at ease.
Brief at ease. Okay, we're back on the record. We're going to continue with SB 61, oil and gas lease, DNR modify net profit share. We have held hearings on this bill on February and March 10th, and have completed public testimony. Today, we plan to adopt a committee substitute, hear a couple of amendments, and gauge the will of the committee. This does have a further referral to finance to look at some of the impacts financially on the legislation. For the record, we have Johnny Meza online, a commercial manager of the Division of Oil and Gas, and Ryan Fitzpatrick, commercial analyst for DNR, for questions that may come up. And first, if we could take up the committee substitute, Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move to adopt the committee substitute for Senate Bill 61, version 32-LS0308/Bravo.
Thank you. I'll object for the purposes of discussion and ask committee aide briefities. Okay, we're back on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to restate that motion, if I may. I move to adopt the committee substitute for Senate Bill 61, version 32-GS1706/Bravo.
Okay, thank you. Is there objection? Seeing no objection, I'll object for purposes of discussion and ask Ms. Tangeman, please, if you could put yourself on the record and walk us through the changes.
Yes. Good afternoon, Chair Rivak and members of the committee. My name is Betty Tangeman, a committee aide to this committee and aide to Senator Rivak. This committee substitute came about after a discussion with legislative legal to conform the Department of Law governor's bill with the drafting requirements of our legislative department and make it consistent with their drafting style and changes in existing laws. So what they came back with were two areas of changes. The first one was changes to the update. In several places, changes are made to the existing statutory language in AS 3630850B32 and AS 3805180J to increase readability and modernize the usage. The Department of Natural Resources Division of Oil and Gas confirmed they agreed with the changes. And then there was additional sections that were added, AS 3805180P, S, and T at the end of the bill. All contain references to modification of royalty rates under AS 3805180J. This bill draft adds language related to the net profit share to those subsections consistent with the addition of the net profit modification option added by the bill in J. The Department of Natural Resources Division of Oil and Gas confirmed that the edits were consistent with their intent.
Thank you, Ms. Tangeman. I'll remove my objection. Do we have further objection? All right, seeing none, the committee substitute for SB 61. Make sure I get this version right here. 6132-GS1706/B has been adopted. Before proceeding with amendments, do any members have additional questions for the DNR team that we have online? Okay, seeing none, next we'll take up amendments. Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number one.
I'll object again for the purposes of explanation.
Yeah, this is simply a language change for clarity, Mr. Chairman. I think the amendment's self-explanatory. It changes net profit share to royalty or net profit share on a lease. And on page 2, lines 17 and 18, it simply revises that language as well to clarify for which additional capital expenditures would make future production no longer to from which without additional capital expenditures future production would no longer be. So there's no substantive change. It's just clarifying language.
Thank you. With that, I'll withdraw my objection. Do we have further objections? Seeing none, Amendment 1 passes. Do we have further amendments? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Amendment number 2, which is B.4.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This amendment requires that if the department is going to enter into an agreement with a leaseholder for a net profit share modification, that they need in the process, as they do their analysis and reach their agreement with the leaseholder, they need to decouple oil and gas. We have elsewhere in our statutes begun the process of decoupling for some of our taxes. We don't care when it comes to royalty because royalty is gross-based, right? So it doesn't really matter. You can't deduct the costs of a new commercial gas development against your legacy oil profits, or rather your legacy oil royalties. But for net profit share, it's the net. The legislature has the opportunity to make those adjustments today or sometime in the future when it comes to our taxes. But because the net profit share lease is a contract, we can only open it by mutual agreement. And so this language would say if we're going to open one, the state needs to get decoupling as part of that agreement.
Thank you, Senator Keel. I would like to hear from our DNR folks online, whether it's Ryan or Johnny, could you please respond to that or give us your input?
Yes, good afternoon, Chair. This is Ryan Fitzpatrick, commercial analyst with Department of Natural Resources. And first, I'd like to extend my appreciation to Senator Keel for taking some time to discuss this amendment with us earlier today. Yes, as we understand the intent behind the amendment, it would require the bifurcation of accounting for oil and for gas for the purpose of calculating net profit shares if there is a modification granted for the net profit share during the course of one of these amendments. It is true there is a similar provision or an analogous provision in the oil and gas production tax statutes. The oil and gas production tax, the analogous section in the production tax statute, is a little bit different in that it actually creates a different tax rate for oil and gas. Oil is taxed at 35% of the production tax value. Gas is taxed at 13% of the gross value, and so creates a little bit more of a complication for the oil and gas taxes in that context. Here for the net for the net profit share component, the oil and gas would still be subject to the exact same net profit share percentage, and so there's a little bit less of an issue in terms of the percentages. There is, however, the potential for some timing issues with regards to when the revenues are received. If the oil accounting and the gas accounting is kept separate, the different development accounts are going to deplete at different rates, and so you might see a timing difference between when revenue is received from the oil component as compared to the gas component. The magnitude of the revenue should still, over time, equate one way or the other. And so I don't know that this is I don't know that the division necessarily has a particular opinion on this, but I also don't see it as something that necessarily creates much in the way of complications for the division either. In our discussion with Senator Keel earlier this morning, and just something that I think we want to see if we can clarify as part of the record here today, if the amendment were to pass, my understanding is that the intent is that the mechanism for dividing the oil expenses and the gas expenses for the purpose of modification would be something that the division would be expected to include in the best interest finding. And so just as a mechanism, I wanted to see if we could clarify that today. But That is, I think, our understanding of this amendment.
Thank you, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That is the intent, that this would be, this mechanism would be something that's in that published best interest finding the public can see, that is presented to LBNA. And importantly, this leaves the commercial analysis section, the DNR, setting that up after their thorough, you know, commercial and fiscal analysis and their negotiation process with the leaseholder. This is not the legislature dictating which way this will be. The whole bill is about a process that gives those commercial analysts tremendous say in how that's structured. And this amendment wouldn't change that, except to say that the lease would need to decouple oil and gas. Those timing issues of when the money comes are pretty important when we're looking to pay for state services.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there a fiscal note attached to this CS? I don't see one in my book. And would this amendment require a fiscal note? Should it pass?
I would imagine we'd get an updated fiscal note.
Put yourself on the record, please. Ms. Tangeman.
Betty Tangeman, for the record. Chair Reback, Betty Tangeman, Legislative Aid. There isn't a new fiscal note for this CS. I would imagine we'd get an updated one.
Correct.
Before we get to finance.
So this heads to finance next, and I'm assume it'll pick up a fiscal note, Senator Stevens.
Okay. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Further discussion, Senator Michiki.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I on the subject of decoupling. The reason for this bill is to hopefully prolong the life of a very marginal development. I'm curious on such a rare occasion where this is expected to be used for a development whose economic life depends on a net profit share agreement, if it's worth complicating by decoupling oil and gas. I mean, again, you're talking about marginal returns, not only for the company, but for the state. I think it's an unnecessary complication that will add to cost both for the state and complicate the entire process. If this were another type of development that was not something that qualified for a net profit share lease, I might feel very differently about that. So I'm inclined to see this as an unnecessary complication. When you think about the best interest finding, if it comes down to the point of where the value that might be associated with decoupling, I don't think it will in this particular case, or in the case of a well that's going to be considered for a net profit share agreement.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. I agree with that. And so if we don't have further discussion, I'm going to maintain my objection. And would the committee aide please call the roll?
Can you just clarify the question?
The question is, shall amendment number 2 pass in committee?
Okay. Senator Kawasaki?
Yes.
Senator Keel?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
No.
Vice Chair Senator Michiki?
No.
And Chairman Reback?
No. Thank you. And so by a vote of 3 nay and 2 yay, amendment number 2 fails. Seeing no further amendments, what is the will of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the CS for Senate Bill 61, version 32-GS1706-B from committee with attached fiscal notes and committee recommendations.
As amended.
As amended.
Object.
Thank you. We have an objection. Would you like to? Yeah, Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chairman. I think there's a lot of unknowns in this bill, and you know, I tried to figure out how we can make it better. If there's methods, I think that the amendment by Senator Keel was appropriate. There's 26 active net profit share leases on the North Slope right now. They're scattered from the Colville River all the way to Point Thompson. You know, at a time when we're trying to figure out how to balance the budget, I find it's difficult to relinquish sort of control over these future net profit share leases to a commissioner and then the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. We won't have a say appropriately because we're the budgeters, we're the people who should be making that budget decision. And so I will continue to object to this bill.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Machicki.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to withdraw my motion. I think it's worthwhile to give committee members a little bit more time till the next meeting, and we can have some additional discussions prior to meeting once again, and then get back together and perhaps move the bill at a future date.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. I agree, and we'll take a look at some of these issues and bring the bill up at a later date. With that, I appreciate the attention of the committee members. Thank you to all of you online standing by to answer questions, and those of you who testified and walked us through our presentation. We appreciate your time and your commitment to the state. With that, we're adjourned at 4:43 p.m.